Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So I spent most of the day watching Bill Barr. Actually, that's not true. I kept running away from the TV because I couldn't handle watching Bill Barr. But as I was watching him and hearing him, it makes me even prouder that we begin every radio show with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman in the fall of 2019 when he testified before the impeachment hearing. I want a split screen. I want Barr, and then I want Vindman, because Vindman speaks the truth, because Vindman is the patriot, because Vindman loves this country, and he was willing to sacrifice his career. He was willing to run every kind of risk in order to make sure that we were told the truth. So I am absolutely honored that I have been carrying his voice every single day for months. We will continue to carry his voice until the election of November 2020, but I want you to hear the voice of a patriot. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry, I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So, I know Ralph Nader, and I'm gonna tell a Ralph Nader story just because I wanna honor Ralph Nader, because we're gonna be chatting with someone from Public Citizen. So this is my way of backing into this interview. And so I've known Ralph four years. And I won't tell the whole story because it's a little bit edgy. But back in 1991, I am running for governor. And guess what? Ralph is running also, but he's not running for governor. He's running sort of for president, but not really. He was handing out pencils that said none of the above. And that was what he was running on. I so love Ralph. And I had given a speech over in Keene, New Hampshire, and it was like 10:30 at night. We were exhausted. I was with my first husband. And we decided we needed to get a cup of coffee in order to sort of get home. So we go into this like Cumberland Farms, and who is sitting in the Cumberland Farms with one of his aides but Ralph Nader? And Ralph goes, Arnie. And I go, Ralph. And the next thing you know, we're sitting at the table and we're shooting the breeze, and Ralph is giving me the skinny on all the candidates running for president. Because I have to tell you, everyone, I will admit it, I was so focused on moi that I really wasn't focusing on them. And let's be honest, it was all the third string Democrats anyway, because they assumed that George Bush would win again. And my favorite happened to be Paul Tsongas, because he was the eat your spinach candidate. And guess what? That was kind of like what I was. And the story he told me about Bill Clinton, I don't want to share right now because it'll just make me cry and probably throw up. But anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to sort of just hang with Ralph Nader. And I have sort of hung with him on many occasions. But I always go to Public Citizen because I value their work and their scholarship. So I received a press release and I'm like, wow, we need to talk about this. And this is what the press release said. White collar crime still pays 10 years after Dodd-Frank. Public Citizen report highlights how executive compensation incentivizes corporate malfeasance. And they sort of go through this laundry list of stuff, and then they offer some suggestions. And as someone who is sort of still disgusted with the fact that nobody did a perp walk after the 2008 economic meltdown, and I've been talking about that ad nauseum, I thought, you know what? This is really important for us to talk about, because as we're looking at the potential for change in 2020, it isn't just about healthcare. It isn't just about an appropriate response to the pandemic. It isn't about only restoring civility and a respect for the rule of law. It is also looking at some of the failures, frankly, of the Obama administration and our inability to sort of correct the record and to change things. So the kind of gross inequality we see, and the fact that, you know, Wall Street is doing remarkably well, even as millions of people have lost their jobs, that's just not acceptable anymore. So joining me right now is Bart Naylor. He is a financial policy advocate at Congress Watch, a division of Public Citizen. Bart, it is an honor and a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for doing this. And I need to ask the first question. So how long have you been hanging out with Ralph Nader at Public Citizen?
Pushing 10 years.
Wow, amazing.
In respect and honor of Colonel Vindman, can I tell my little story of my coming of some awareness of how Washington works?
I would adore it. So tell me.
I spent the afternoon listening to much of the bar testimony. After I bicycled into Washington and paid my respects to Congressman Lewis, the public is allowed to walk past his casket, which is at the top of the Capitol steps, and you get in a line. Half hour later, you're at the bottom of the Capitol steps. So I'm from Boise, Idaho, and I went to Boise High School, the oldest high school in Boise, and our rival high school is Borah High School. I detest Borah High School to this day. At one of my high school reunions, I found out that one of my classmates had married somebody from Borah, and I was appalled because mixed marriages don't work. You know, you mentioned Borah High School to me, and I, you know, we're not gonna be, get along very well.
Okay.
Well, I did take high school, what was it called? Civics or political science. And I learned how laws were made. They were made by men of good faith, getting into a room and marshaling the best studies and together, putting their minds together, coming out with the best product.
Right.
But I learned after coming here that it's Boise versus Borah.
Right. Wow. Wow. You're absolutely right. It is Boise. And, but it is that way in DC. It's become that way almost in every legislature across the country, but it has devolved. And I'm going to say that because what you don't know about me, and my audience has heard me tell this story, but I ran for the Constitutional Convention in New Hampshire in 1984. It was like a 6-week citizen type of thing. You weren't, didn't run as a Republican, you didn't run as a Democrat, and it was only 6 weeks. You know, it was like, if I was gonna test myself, this is the perfect time to test myself. And I won, okay? It was really exciting. But the day that I won, I found that I was pregnant with my second kid, okay? So I show up 7 months pregnant, you just imagine. So here I'm, this young woman in this really interesting Constitutional Convention, and it was the best experience of my whole life. And I was on a committee called the Executive Committee that was made up of the who's who of the Republican Party. The chairman was the former Republican governor. The vice chairman was the former president of the Senate of Republican. The Republican majority leader served on my committee. So it was really, and there were only two girls, okay? So it was like 26 men and two girls. And one of them happened to be pregnant, moi. So at the end of the 6 weeks, it was, I fell in love with them. They taught me so much. They brought me under their wing. I learned from them. We could disagree without being disagreeable. We would challenge each other, but the challenge wasn't a threat. The challenge was honest debate, okay? It was incredible. And at the end of the 6 weeks, I'm sort of waddling out of the room, and the Republican majority leader comes up to me and says to me, "So Arnie, what are you doing in the fall?" I looked down at my stomach and I said, "I'm having a baby, Bruce." And I said, I know that, Arnie. I said, "What are you asking?" He said, "Ever thought about serving in the New Hampshire legislature?" Now remember, this is the Republican majority leader. And I get really quiet. And I said, "I'm not sure I know how to break this to you, Bruce, but I think I'm a Democrat. In fact, I think I'm a liberal Democrat." And Bruce starts laughing hysterically and says, "We could tell that too, Arnie." And I said, "So what are you asking?" And he said, "You know, Arnie, 75% of what we do in the New Hampshire legislature is about what's good for New Hampshire. And 25% of it is partisan. And I think we need you for the 75%. I want everyone to know that who asked me to run was the Republican majority leader. To this day, I mean, I cry when I tell that story because it was different. And what you don't know, Bart, is I was the first female to run for governor on a major party platform. I beat the party chairman in the 5-term Congress and won my nomination. I didn't win the election, but I came close. You know, it was the year of Bill Clinton. I was just telling Ken Barnes that Bill Clinton got 38.5% of the vote and won New Hampshire because of Ross Perot. And I got 39.95%. Of course, I lost, but I tell everyone it came in on my skirt tails. You know, so I want people to know that what you see in Washington, what I watched on television, what I see happening makes me want to take a shower. Because I found politics was not only something positive for me, but it was a place where I practiced hope. I actually practiced hope. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I love Ralph Nader, because he's never stopped fighting. He's never stopped hoping. He's never stopped giving us the information we need. Because if enough of us have this information at our fingertips, we will make a much wiser decision. So Bart, now that we both waxed poetic and told these stories to everyone, which is really important, because in the end, we do represent, I think, what is good about policy and what is good about politics. And we need to find more voices, and we need to elect more people that will do that, because in the end, that's the only way our democracy will survive. So talk to me about this report. What does this report look at? Because you kind of go through these 10 years and you sort of point out, what did Dodd-Frank do or what didn't it do? And where are we now? What is this snapshot? And why do we still have to make some significant changes?
Two reasons for this report. One is to make note of, as you say, the 10th year since Congress and President Obama responded to the 2008 financial crash. And that was with the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. There are 400 rules that are required to be written in it. I would say 12 of them are real important, such as the Volcker Rule to try to stop gambling by Wall Street. Making mortgages to be made to people who can afford to repay them. But one of them goes to the root cause of the crash itself. The crash happened because bankers were paid to crash it. And by that I mean they committed massive fraud in the pursuit of making personal fortunes, and they did. Even at Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, which both went bankrupt, the top five guys, and I mentioned five guys because that's what's disclosed in publicly traded companies by the SEC, they made $200 million each in the half decade leading to the crash. So for their failure, they were richly rewarded. I say this because one of the rules was to say, we got to fix that. Pay caused the crash. Let's make sure pay doesn't cause another crash. Very few of the rules had a deadline on them. This one did. And the deadline was May 2011. And now I pause for dramatic effect and let people do the math and guess. It has not been finalized. There is no rule that applies to bankers as to how they should have their pay bridled, even though Congress said, regulators, write the guardrails, tell us what the speed limit should be, and get it done by May 2011. That's nine years ago. So to me, Dodd-Frank is a failure. Yes. It's a failure of regulators. It's a failure that they wrote it that way. You don't have to write a law and say, here's the law, but it actually doesn't go into effect until the police department actually puts up the road signs. You have to drive 55. If you're caught driving 65, you'll be, and we hope they post the sign, but you still have to drive 55. So that's what it should have said.
Right.
It didn't. In part because the people writing this were not from the left. They were not reformers. They were Wall Street guys. And, you know, you are from a certain culture.
Well, let's be honest. I remember right after the 2008 economic meltdown, I don't remember the name of the senator, but he was on the floor going, the banks own this place. And one of the things that I have sort of looked at over the years is the revolving door, you know, and you begin to sort of, you know, pay to play, and you begin to sort of see all these things. It is not surprising. Dodd-Frank was drained of any kind of real enforcement from the moment it was written. I mean, look where Barney Frank went after he left the Congress. I mean, make me gag. You know, this is the guy that everybody said, oh, look what that, I said, no, look what he did. Tell me there wasn't some sort of incentive for him to know that when you leave, well, trust me, you're going to land with a parachute. So you talked about the fraud. What do you mean by that word? Don't throw a word out. without giving me the definition of the kind of fraud you're talking about that these bankers basically incurred. Give me some specifics here so people will understand. I mean, making a lot of money isn't fraudulent. Let's remember this. But making a lot of money in certain ways may in fact be fraudulent. So what I want you to do is connect the dots, Bart.
Well, the frauds which were brought in cases by the Justice Department, and the banks paid $200 billion in fines because of them, were many, but the basic one had to do with packaging mortgages into mortgage-backed securities and selling them when they knew that many of the mortgages were bad. About the only name that ever gets mentioned or ever was mentioned in the multiple cases brought by the Justice Department was Rebecca Marone. And she ran at Countrywide the so-called quality control program. And that's where, before they actually sell it to the public, and it'll be bought by pension funds and the Iceland government.
Right. They spread the crap around.
They go through every mortgage and make sure it's kosher. That in fact, the person says, I'm a hairdresser and I make $160,000 a year. Or I'm a bartender and I make $250,000 a year, and make the phone call to the bar and say, so Susie tells us she makes $250,000. Is that true? Well, they did not. They actually called it the high speed swim lane. And Rebecca didn't do this herself. She just managed people. Yeah. They had a quota. You have to go through one mortgage application per half minute. And if you put too many question marks on it, we move you to a different division. You don't get to work in the high-speed swim lane anymore. So these mortgages were packaged, a lot of more crappy, and we saw they defaulted massively. Now, lots of people knew this, and I can go through other frauds.
Oh, no. So the reason I'm pushing you on this is that I have a personal angle here. We named our business school in New Hampshire after a guy named Peter T. Paul. I asked the question after that he cut a check for $28 million and they renamed the school after him. I asked the question, so how did he make his money? And guess what, Bart? People hadn't asked. So guess what I found out? He's the father of liar loans. Okay? This is what you're talking about. Yeah. I want people to connect the dots. What you were talking about, what they packaged and sold to pensioners and sold in these packages were liar loans. That's exactly what a liar loan is. A liar loan is when you call the bar and say, you're really paying them $250,000 a year? And they go, who are you talking about? You know, I mean, that is exactly what you're saying. We named our state university business school after the father of liar loans. Understand, not only has it not stopped, we still celebrate them.
So I was the head of investigation for the U.S. Senate Banking Committee during the takeover frenzy of the 1980s, when the likes of Ronald Perelman would go in and gut a company. He would take it over with a lot of leverage. Sometimes they could pay, sometimes they couldn't, but they had to lay off a lot of workers and close factory and cut philanthropy and so forth. My son graduated from the Ronald Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Every year he comes to sort of first year party, and he is known to go up to the female students, half of med students now are female, and whisper, you're really here to just marry a doctor, aren't you?
I know. I mean, it's all right. So now we got the fraud. Now right. We know that Dodd-Frank is celebrating its 10th year, and that so much of it hasn't actually either been enforced or happened, or it was even gutted before it became law. So where are we now?
This is a big cautionary tale.
Okay.
And we can circle back to far more than bankers do bad stuff because they're paid to do it. Right now, we are shoving trillions of dollars out of Washington into America, hoping that we can get people, 53% of whom only have $400 in savings, which is now long gone, and just keep them alive, literally keep them alive, keep them able to buy groceries.
I know.
But there's a problem. What if, as in 2008, in the bailout there, too much of the money gets into the hands of profiteers? What if there are no conditions on this money? We need conditions, or else battlefield scavengers are going to come in and take precious money away from workers. And that's the fight that we're in Washington right now. The set we lost in the CARES Act, the $2.3 trillion, which has a $500 billion facility for corporations, of which about, I can't remember the exact number, I'll make it up, like $20 billion is for airlines. The only condition is that airline CEOs can only be paid $3 million plus half of that, which was more than $3 million last year. The average airline executive, the big, what is it, three, got $16 million. So they get 3 plus 8. So they have to get out of bed in the morning and pay the electric bill on only $11 million. That's the only condition. For the rest of the 450 or so billion dollars that is going out, leveraged with Fed money that will be trillions of dollars, the number of conditions on CEO pay is this, zero. We need to change that. This money, these CEOs of effectively government-funded companies should be working for $1 a year. Frankly, they have enough already. They should be paid nothing. Right. But the fact that they could be paid a lot of taxpayer dollars is anathema. And what if they actually abuse the money? What if they commit some other fraud, mining problems, or cut corners at Boeing and more airliners fall out of the air? When the government finds them, who's going to pay that? Oh, it's going to be the taxpayers. Right. Is that fair? No, it should be the managers themselves who abuse the money. That is one of the dozens of reforms we talked about at the end.
Okay, so Bart, now that the money is out the door, how is it possible to sort of claw back? There's probably going to be another bill. There's going to be at least two or three more. You know that.
It's not out the door. Okay. The happy ending.
Oh,
is
good.
Of Title IV of the CARES Act, the $500 billion, very little other than to the airlines has actually left the door. In part, because some of the companies can get money from other sources. In part, the Fed unilaterally put a condition, and that is no buybacks. What's a buyback? Mm-hmm. It's when a company buys back its own stock. Right. Why would they do that? When you buy anything, the price goes up. Well, the price of the stock goes up. And who cares most about that? The CEO, because his pay, and I'm using him, not because I'm not a feminist, but because frankly, that's who they are. Mm-hmm. His pay goes up.
Okay.
So they don't want restrictions on buybacks. They waited to get to be CEO so they can manipulate the stock price so that they could maximize their pay. So anyway, the money hasn't left, and the Fed can't do this unilaterally. It has to have Mnuchin agree, and Mnuchin comes from the wrong end of the universe of ethics to make this decision. So we need Congress to do this.
Yeah, but you've got McConnell. The problem is you have a U.S. Senate that is devoid of anything in the way of ethics, integrity. I mean, what's the check? How many commas in it? And I'll do it. I mean, okay, I'm just trying to figure out what to do.
You're the one that brought up Ralph Nader is hopeful. So don't rain on my parade. Okay. We are going to try.
Well, I think it's really important that, you build this case. Now the question is, so who's carrying your message in the U.S. Senate? Who sounds like Bart in the U.S. Senate that will get time on CNN, MSNBC, C-SPAN will make sure that they're glued to them? Who tells the story? Because people are outraged. They're outraged that we created more billionaires during a pandemic. We're outraged because the billionaires made more money. We're outraged because Bezos made, 13.5 billion in one day. I mean, all those things, together as you're saying, and you're going to take away my $600 in unemployment benefits, I want to know who sings your song.
Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Chuck Schumer.
Okay.
I'm embarrassed. Wisconsin. She replaced Proxmire two generations back. Baldwin.
Tammy Baldwin.
Actually, Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana. You say sings. He doesn't sing, but he does whisper. And that's in the Senate. So we have voices. Unfortunately, among the reasons this section of Dodd-Frank has stalled is the people who fund campaigns are the 0.1%.
Yes, I know.
And they fund both sides. So I'm from the ruling class. I went to Harvard, and my forebears founded Holden Chapel, which is a very small building, but it's 200 years old. Because my family understood you didn't just buy the politicians, you bought the ministers too. That is the sinister way. You don't get and stay in the ruling class because you're stupid and you don't know how to use your money. So anyway, both sides are probably reluctant to stifle senior pay because it's coming, a small tithing is coming to them.
Right, right. Bart, I have to let you go. I don't want to let you go. So here's the deal. You're coming on like more, like regular. These are the conversations we need to have. Donald Trump is a distraction, intentionally. I mean, we're going to be going to Portland next, which is a really important story. We went to Portland last night. We're going to continue to do this because this is fascism. I mean, but this is the other piece that we need to focus on as well. And because there's such a cacophony of noise out there, we don't necessarily focus on it. But if we don't focus on it, this too undermines our ability to not only repair our democracy, which is in incredible need of repair, but also to have an economy that works for us. So Bart, thank you so much. Tell Ralph Nader Arnie sends her love. And that we have to get him on the air as well, and that it's been too long. But I appreciate Public Citizen and all you do. Thank you so much.
Namaste.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. When we come back, we are going to Portland on the streets. That's what I love. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day more than 10,000 African Americans marched down New York's Fifth Avenue in what is known as the Silent Parade. The protest came in the aftermath of the July 2nd East St. Louis race riot and a number of lynchings in Texas. Organized by black scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, and the NAACP, the Silent Parade protested lynchings and anti-black violence. Children led the march dressed in white. Women, who were also dressed in white, followed them. Men dressed in dark suits marched behind. It was considered the first public protest of racial violence in the United States. Alexis Newman describes the scene as the parade proceeds to Madison Square. The marchers carried banners and posters stating their reasons for the march. Both participants and onlookers remarked that this protest was unlike any other seen in the city and the nation. There were no chants, no songs, just silence. Some signs read, "Mother, do lynchers go to heaven?" and "Mr. President, why not make America safe for democracy?" Protesters hoped President Woodrow Wilson would make good on his election promises to promote rights for blacks. But Wilson took no action. In fact, he opposed anti-lynching legislation and continued segregationist policies in federal offices. In an editorial for the New York Age, James Weldon Johnson pointed out, quote, that their brothers and sisters, people just like them, were Jim Crowed and segregated and disenfranchised and oppressed and lynched and burned alive in this, the greatest republic in the world, the great leader in the fight for democracy and humanity.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I fight a thought deep.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So yesterday, we went to the University of Oregon and we talked to a political science professor who was fascinating and told us an amazing story about the history of Oregon, that it was really set up as a white state. It was intentionally white. You couldn't have a slave and come to Oregon. You couldn't have be a free black and come to Oregon. He said it was just, it was basically the definition of white supremacy, and that was what it was based on. And he said, so a lot of what you're seeing now is still sort of the legacy of Oregon coming to terms with its past and with its present. And so as he was sort of describing what was going on and what was happening with Donald Trump sending in his paramilitary, secret police, border patrol, whatever it is that he's doing that we don't really know because they don't identify themselves. I had a friend from Vermont who said, do you want to talk to someone who's been covering this from the streets? And I went, oh my God, yes. And so let me introduce you to Bea Lake. Bea is a resident of Portland. You've been covering the protest, Bea. So Bea, share with my audience exactly who you are, how you got to cover this, because this is also kind of an interesting story, because what we know about the media is local media has basically been gutted. You know, we've been seeing so much consolidation, and, you know, there's all the fly-in media that comes in from, you know, NBC, because they want to do the color story. So they'll be there to watch, but they're not there sort of understanding what's making up the crowds. Who are the crowds? You know who they are. So I want you to explain to my audience, who is Bea? How did you get to the place where you are now actually covering this? Because it's not what you do, but it's what you have become.
Sure, yes. So I'm friends with a guy named Robert Evans who works with iHeartMedia and does a bunch of podcasts. And he has done a lot of on the ground. He put out a thing called It Could Happen Here that was looking at some of the contemporary political tensions in American culture and how that might spiral into a hypothetical civil war and what that would look like. He also lives in Portland. And so after George Floyd was murdered, after the Minneapolis precinct was set on fire, and then this crowd of thousands descended on downtown Portland and smashed up the lobby of the Justice Center, which is the headquarters of the Portland Police Bureau, our local police department. The mayor then implemented a curfew amidst some really harsh crackdowns. Robert got in touch with me and my partner and said, so will you be photographers for me? Because I need extra eyes on the ground. And I need people to watch my back because police had been deploying riot munitions liberally. One of the first days of protests, there's some really upsetting footage of people sitting in the middle of an intersection and police rushing them and clubbing them into the ground. People who are literally sitting with their hands over their heads. Basically, in order to be able to help out our friend, we started going out and we started taking pictures and, you know, recording what was going on and reporting on it, mostly via Twitter. And then through that, ended up connected with a lot of other local journalists, some of whom have been doing this for quite some time. Sergio Olmos and Tuck Woodstock are two folks I definitely want to shout out who have been doing on-the-ground reporting. And speaking of local media being gutted, the Portland Mercury, which is a local weekly, financially has been pretty gutted by COVID and has actually stopped being able to publish paper issues. On the other hand, they've turned over pretty much their entire budget to a small group of reporters who are mostly covering this stuff at this point, what's going on the ground in downtown Portland. The editor has actually started doing some on-the-ground reporting too, because there's just not that many folks left. But, you know, Alex Linsky, Lindsay Smith, and a number of others have been working with them as well.
Well, it's first of all, the reason why people like you and the people like your weekly paper, the one of the things that I regret having sort of been around when there was significant local media is that not only do they know people, they have institutional memory. Yeah. So they recognize who's there. They know the crazy quilt of people who've come. They know what's different from the first 10 days to the next 10 days to the next 10 days, because it keeps changing over the course of this last 50 or 60 days. And I think this is really important, because when you fly in, you don't know anyone. You're just taking a picture. And a picture doesn't tell you really sort of the underbelly of the story. And that's where B, you are so incredibly important because this is your community. You know these people.
Well, and I think one of the things that that has been getting lost in the national conversation, and we've seen, you know, we saw last night some, we call them the parachutes, folks who show up from national media. There was, you know, folks who show up and are, it's like they're critiquing a concert. It's like they're there for you know, to talk about, oh, well, how's this show compared to the shows in the other towns? And we heard a guy who admitted that he hadn't been on the ground very long talking about like, well, you know, I'm flying back to DC tomorrow. It just feels like, I don't know, here's a, like comparing it as though it were a performance. When the fact of the matter is, well, folks are focused on Portland right now because of the federal presence and because of the, you know, the presidential order and the way that that's been playing out. It's worth noting that as far as we can tell, the presidential order came down on Portland the hardest because Fox News had a feature where they used a lot of local journalist footage when a statue of George Washington got pulled down by some teenagers. And that was enough to get the president really excited about Portland. However, there's an entire history. You alluded to the history of Oregon. So the Portland Police Bureau, you know, as you, I'm sure you talked about yesterday, Portland Police Bureau spent a substantial portion of the time in the 20s when basically the entire government of Oregon was synonymous with the Ku Klux Klan. Portland Police Bureau functioned as more or less a wing of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. But then, you know, in the 1990s, Portland was a hotbed of sort of fights between open neo-Nazi skinhead gangs and such and anti-fascist groups. And there's, you know, the Portland Police Association, the police union that was set on fire last week, and the Portland Police Bureau, the department, have a legacy of deep-seated racism that it's not past. There's a guy named Mark Kruger who was disciplined in the early 2000s for repeatedly as head of the gang unit in the Portland Police Bureau, dressing up in Nazi uniforms, building shrines to Nazis on city property, and taking pictures of himself in his Nazi uniforms next to his Nazi shrines that he built on city property. He was disciplined for this when he was reported by one of his colleagues. The woman who reported him was drummed out of the Portland Police Bureau. The Portland Police Association then pressured the mayor and the chief of police until they completely cleared out his disciplinary record, expunged his disciplinary record, and then they transferred him. So instead of being in charge of the gang unit, the gang task force, he was instead placed in charge.
Okay, we're losing you. Are you having trouble hearing him at all, Ken? Or is it just me?
He's getting softer.
I want to make sure.
That may be our internet.
That's much better. You're closer to the mic, I think.
I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose a word of this, B.
So Mark Kruger had been in charge of the gang task force, was disciplined for his Nazi cosplay, and then, but the person who reported him for that was drummed out of the Portland Police Bureau, and then under pressure from the Portland Police Association, the police union, his record was expunged. He got a letter of apology from the chief of police at the time, Mike Reese, who's now the Multnomah County Sheriff. And then he was transferred. So instead of being in charge of the gang task force, which has historically targeted people of color for being associated with other people of color, he was then transferred instead to being in charge of the entire evidence division for the Portland Police Bureau.
Your voice is fading again.
All right, keep going. Speak a little louder.
I'm not sure what's going on here.
I don't know either, but that's fine. People, I hate to say this, because of everyone zooming and losing everyone, people are getting used to their ears accommodating what's happening. So we will try to fix it too.
So my point here with Mark Kruger, and you know, he retired with a full pension.
When did he retire?
In 2010, he retired with full pension in 2010. Okay. So this is not, you know, this is not ancient history.
Right.
And meanwhile, you know, Danielle Outlaw, who was brought in as the police chief and then recently transferred to become the police chief of Philadelphia, she was brought up from Oakland, and in 2018 there were running street battles where basically far right groups were showing up in Portland and just beating people in the streets. And when anti-fascist groups showed up to confront those groups, the Portland police shot an anti-fascist activist point blank in the back of the head with a tear gas canister that went through their bike helmet and embedded in their skull. And the chief of police at the time, Danny Loutlaw, who's a black woman, her response at the time was to go on a right-wing podcast and laugh about the incident and say that anti-fascists were mad because they got their noses bloodied. So the history of the Portland Police Bureau is long and steeped in racism and violence. And currently, you mentioned the idea that Trump is a distraction. Currently, the consensus on the ground from activists and journalists who have been covering this for a long time is the federal presence is a distraction. Every activist in Portland would be thrilled, I think it's safe to say, if the feds packed up and went home tomorrow and folks could get back to focusing on the Portland Police Bureau.
So let me ask a question as well, because this is just incredibly fascinating. Again, history matters, everyone. History matters. That's one of the reasons why I went to Joe Lowndes yesterday from University of Oregon. But B, you said the feds are a distraction, that everybody would want the feds to leave. One of the things I'm hearing, and tell me whether this is true or not, because you know this community, is that because the feds are here, more people are showing up. Because now, I mean, they may have been watching from the sidelines, thinking, all right, they're right about this, but you know, I don't do this kind of thing. But in an interesting way, the federal presence is now bringing a whole new cast of characters in. On the side of Black Lives Matter and the police issues and whatever, in part because they're so offended by the outrageous behavior of Donald Trump's, you know, paramilitary. And in an interesting way, instead of it quieting things down, it has actually sort of enhanced the cacophony of voices that are coming. And these are voices that historically would not be there, but the Fed's behavior is now even driving them into the mix. Is that correct?
I think there's certainly a degree to which that's true. I think it also has brought attention, you know, and as soon as attention is there, people feel more motivated. I think another thing, to add a little bit of nuance, I said that the feds were a distraction, and in a way that's true, and in a way it's not, because the other thing that's true is that in the same way that people who have felt sympathetic to Black Lives Matter, but maybe haven't felt motivated to get out in the streets, get spurred on by federal presence in seeming violation of the Constitution and a bajillion other things. The other thing that's true is that I think one of the reasons that the federal presence has become such a sort of a signpost, such an important thing for this administration, is because they see in organizations like the Portland Police Bureau, they see an ally.
Fellow traveler, exactly right.
Yes,
exactly,
absolutely. Right. The Trump administration, I think it's safe to say, the Portland Police Bureau, before the feds deployed in Portland in their current capacity, the Portland Police Bureau had just done a number of very interesting things, and the Portland Police Association as well. Portland Police Bureau, one of their spokespeople, had presented images of crowd tactics that had been developed during the Hong Kong protests, mm-hmm. and showed these as an example of what the Portland police were up against. And again, this was tactics developed by the Hong Kong protesters to resist a totalitarian takeover of their city. And the Portland police showed this graphic and didn't see that as painting them in a bad light. They said, we are the flip side of the Hong Kong equation, and that's why we need more force to suppress this.
That's right. And not realizing, not realizing what is ruling China and who Xi is.
Right, and similarly, the other thing that happened, so there was a huge push, there was a starting point of a demand that was made by activists that the Portland Police Bureau, which is by far the largest expenditure in Portland, $250 million, that its budget be reduced by $50 million as a starting point. to start trimming away some of the militarized excess of the programs, to start returning the budget to where it was in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And this was resisted so strenuously by the Portland Police Association, the union, and the Portland Police Bureau, that first the city basically found itself in a bind, and city government did not follow through on that demand. They reduced by $15 million, and when you actually get down to it, they reduced by $15 million over the proposed budget, which was only a reduction of about $3 million from where it was last year.
Okay.
Could I ask you?
Yeah, sorry, Ken.
Can I just ask you to flesh out a distinction for me? I understand from various articles and everything that there's essentially two different groups of protesters, that during the day and early evening, the protesters are the same as protesters in most other cities, sort of nonviolent and dealing with Black Lives Matter and police brutality and excess force and all of that, but nonviolent, and that, you know, sometime after midnight, when all of the other protests, the nonviolent protesters have gone home, the anarchists come out, and that's the only ones that Trump talks about and that he justifies his thugs with. And you don't look like you agree with that.
I don't. No.
Good. So clarify the record, please.
Yeah. So one of the things that's been getting a lot of media coverage lately is the Wall of Moms, right?
Yes.
So the wall, it's important to like talk about what, in Portland especially, what the Wall of Moms is, and mm-hmm. and the Wall of Moms as an organ, as like a tactic, as a media presence, has transferred over its leadership and is being directed by a group called Don't Shoot PDX, which has been a police accountability group that has been active in Portland for a very long time and is Black led. And so there's been some discussion of like whether the Wall of Moms is a distraction because there's a lot of white women. Portland is a very white city. It is one of the whitest major cities in the United States. However, the idea that there are good protesters and bad protesters is something that way before the feds showed up, the Portland police were trying to spin that narrative. Way before the feds showed up, the Portland police would repeatedly make announcements over the LRAD, which is a speaker that they use for announcements that can also be turned up in volume until it is as loud as a gunshot and can permanently damage people's hearing and used as an offensive weapon. They would make announcements over this LRAD saying, we want this protest to remain peaceful. All peaceful demonstrators should proceed, and try and give people directions. If you're a peaceful demonstrator, these are the orders you have to follow. Now the Portland police—
unconstitutional.
Yes. Yeah, keep going, yes, yes.
Now the Portland police, you know, they have a long history of brutality, and they were under FBI investigation for their record of killing mentally ill people. And they have a terrible record with the homeless population and a terrible record with the population of color. And so when we talk about nonviolent versus violent protesters, I will say that the record of like what is considered to be violence is really striking. And when you have when you have, as you did last night, because I was down there again last night, you have a Wall of Moms, a multiracial group, and a Wall of Vets. So the Wall of Moms in yellow t-shirts and bike helmets to protect themselves from impact munitions, which are being fired at eye level in violation of the manufacturer's instructions by federal officers. And you have the Wall of Vets, who are wearing white t-shirts, and they are standing in clouds of tear gas and dodging impact munitions. And you have the federal forces on their speaker saying all peaceful protesters should move to the north. The question of who gets to be peaceful in those situations is very interesting because
I gotta let you go. I'm so over time. Bea Lake is a freelance journalist in Portland, Oregon. She works with the 45th Parallel Absurdist Brigade, a press collective for on-the-ground reporting of the George Floyd protests and law enforcement response. Will you come back?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. I wanna check in. And I wanna check in even after maybe the protests have dissipated, because I wanna know the after story as well, because it isn't about this moment. It is about much more than this moment. And I think your ears and your eyes are too important. So thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Well, I've got a good helmet to protect my ears and my eyes.
That's absolutely, absolutely. Anyway, take care of yourself, you promise?
Thank you so much.
All right.
Yes, be safe.
This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. Oh, God, B. I need 2 hours of you. I needed 2 hours of Bart.
I also do just want to put out there that there's a lot of other journalists who have been doing this stuff for longer. And if you'd like,
So what I'm going to do is you didn't hear me, but at the very beginning of our show, we do a Colonel Vindman. We start every single day and we've been doing it for months. I'm the kind of person that likes a theme. I like things that are repetitious. I want people to understand something, but understand something from every angle because it's really important. So that's one of the reasons why I did Joe yesterday and I did B today. So understand that I want people to understand that this isn't a different story, but they have a different experience. You know, I keep saying that, you know, I when I ran for office, I was talking about that women want equality, but equality isn't sameness. And I use this example. I said 2 + 2 = 4. 3 + 1 = 4. 5 - 1 = 4. They're equal, but not the same. So what I want you, and I want those other voices, they need to sort of be part of this story that we tell. So you can share anything with me. And if there's an angle that needs to be told and isn't being told in the national media, you better get the heck on the email and say, Arnie, we got to cover this. You promise?
Sure, absolutely.
Right, well, I love you.
Can I just say, I really think that what you're talking about in the last few minutes is something that
nobody's
I just haven't
covering.
Seen in the national media at all.
Which is
you're talking about the impact munitions and like violence directed at people. And,
well, no, the idea that the cops are doing, which is the cops are
yes, absolutely.
the good protester and the bad protester.
And
yes.
the narrative of that has always been there, but you know, what's the actual facts on the ground? Because I thought at least everybody agreed that the people during the day, the Black Lives Matter protests were peaceful. They were nonviolent. They're not tearing down the fence.
Well, but again, I feel like it's one of those things that like, there's been some really good stuff that I've seen recently talking about like nonviolence as a tactic and in the Black liberation movement in the 60s and 70s, nonviolence was understood as a tactical position. It wasn't understood as a moral litmus test. And the understanding was you were only going to be able to use nonviolence as a tactic when there were certain circumstances on the ground in terms of what response was going to be.
I want to carry on this conversation with that kind of context so that we can, because remember, you're the first city. Then it'll be Chicago. Then it will be, I mean, so it's really important. Your experience is really important because we need to learn. And this is where you are so wonderful because we're learning our lessons. We're learning the language. We're learning the tactics because you know what? It's not going to change. They'll use the same tactics over and over again because it's the tactics they know.
Yeah.
So I want people to be aware of them because I don't want them to be manipulated by them. B, you are terrific. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. No, this is a pleasure.
Thanks. All right, take care of yourself.
Thanks.
All right, bye-bye. Ciao.
Bye.
Do you hear the people singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Will you join in a crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? Beyond the barricade, is there a world you long to see? Then join in the fight that will give you the right to be free. Do you hear the people sing? Some will live. Will you stand up and take your chance? The blood of the martyrs will water the meadows of France.